Campus FM jippreżenta Laboratorju Letterarju. Vjaġġ fid-dinja tal-letteratura komparata. In today's program of Laboratorio Letterario, my colleague Dr. Ivanka Luz from the Department of English of the Faculty of Arts and myself will be interviewing the American scholar and literary critic Professor Timothy Batty. A translator into English of works by Hans Robert Jauss and Paul de Man, among others, Professor Timothy Batty has also published extensively on literary historiography, the rapport between literature and philosophy, and the European lyric tradition. His publications include Allegories of History and Ends of the Lyric, Direction and Consequence in Western Poetry. Professor Batty has taught extensively at Yale University, Cornell University, Northwestern University, and, more recently, the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. His current research interests include the lyric tradition and questions of blindness. Yes, Tim, I'd like to ask you a question on one of your books, which is called Ends of the Lyric, in which you examine the ends of poetry through endings of poems by Shakespeare, Coleridge, Leopardi, Stevens, and also other poets. Can you talk about this intriguing title of your work?
Yes, happily. As you know, I tried to demonstrate that lyric poems, unlike novels or dramas, in my judgment, are so structured that, strictly speaking, they don't end, even though they come to a formal last line on a page or after several pages. They involve the reader in a kind of looping or cycling back to the title, to the first line, ending not at an end point, but in a re-entry into reflection and reading. What I found was that this is not necessarily historically determined, that we cannot, as it were, speak of ends of the lyric that become ever more attenuated or difficult or complex as time progresses. But it is interesting to note that the question of the end purpose or the vitality of lyric does get increasingly pointed and posed in the modern lyric. And that is why I chose, as one of the last chapters in the book, a treatment of the French, German, Jewish poet Paul Celan. You may know that his associate, the philosopher Theodor Adorno, famously said once that it was barbaric to write poetry after Auschwitz. He later went on, after he befriended Paul Celan, to retract that statement, to qualify it, to say, in fact, that poetry will go on, it should be written, not that it is prohibited after Auschwitz, but on the condition that it takes the experience of Auschwitz into its own consideration. And I believe that the lyric, especially with Paul Celan and after Paul Celan, raises the issue of why lyric should still continue after such massive historic barbarity. And to that extent, then, the lyric does not end at a historical moment. It can, as it were, once again recycle and retreat the most massive questions of endings in human history.
Yeah, a question which I would like to ask, following on from Gloria's question, is how what you have said could possibly connect with the current rhetoric of ends, what one critic has called the contemporary rhetoric of endism, with a lot being said about the end of poetry, the end of literature, the end of philosophy, almost as if we are always in a state of post. But this state of post seems to be constructed in simplistic terms of successiveness. What are your views about that?
Well, as you know, Ivan, our culture, at least in its Christian tradition, perhaps as well in its Jewish tradition, relies on a concept of apocalypse, that at some point time is coming to an end, that there will be a messianic or a second messianic moment. So that indeed we cannot think even about succession or progress in our Judeo-Christian culture without a horizon of the apocalyptic. Now, it is also true that there seems to be a cheapening or an ever broader diffusion of this rhetoric of the end of this and the post that, and that there is perhaps ironically a defusing or diluting or draining of the apocalyptic force that is, I believe, foundational to our thinking, not just our religious thinking, but also our historical thinking. And so my feeling is that there's a kind of tension, perhaps one could say an ironic tension, between a necessary thought of the apocalyptic, and this is no laughing matter these days with respect to environmental or violent eventualities, and on the other hand, a kind of, as you said, a successive or even perhaps a reiterative sense that the more we speak of one era or one mode of culture or humanity coming to an end, that perhaps masks a certain anxiety that, after all, things go on and on and on.
Talking about endings and talking in these apocalyptic terms, do you think that the print culture has now ended or is approaching its end? And again, you were talking about these apocalyptic visions. We are dominated, obviously, by an image culture. One image which immediately came to mind was that of the Twin Towers and 9/11. Well, I'd like to know what you think about print culture, whether it's approaching its end, the image culture dominating the print culture and basically killing it, and also, however, we are here on the radio using our voices. So what do we do with this voice culture? How important is this voice culture and its rapport with print and image?
This is a fascinating question. I am unhappy to agree that print culture, and especially, let us say, book culture, seems to be in danger. You may know that only 1 in 7 Americans buys a book a year, an astonishing and perilous fact. That it also corresponds to the fact that only 1 in 7 Americans have a passport, and therefore travel outside the immediate domain is perhaps only a statistical coincidence, but it raises the question of curiosity and whether any medium has ever been as good in provoking and responding to curiosity as the book is. Newspaper reading is declining not only in America, but also in France, perhaps elsewhere in Europe. So that, yes, clearly the print culture is being changed, and perhaps much for the worst. On the other hand, people still read on the net. Perhaps in terms of minutes or hours per day, they read as much as ever. The different modality of reading, whether holding a book in one's hands or being before a screen, is, I think, an immensely interesting question, one that has, I think, scarcely begun to be reflected upon. And with respect to image culture, we are saturated, but when we think we are saturated, there's yet more poured upon us. And one really needs to ask at a certain moment, do we need more images, or can we continue to absorb them in a way that is reflective. I fear in some way that we become automatistic, robot-like in a kind of programmed response to images. And yet if we set up this apparently a kind of polarity between the benefits of the book culture or the print culture and the dangers of the image culture, we fall, I think, into a trap, because clearly there are alternatives, and here we come to your aspect of voice culture. Listening to a voice and talking reflectively about issues is something that people still do. They do it around tables, they do it in cafes, they do it in seminar rooms, and fortunately they do it on the radio. And here I think Europe has a tremendous advantage, which is a culture of the voice. People in my experience are more patient. Even if they interrupt one another frequently in Europe, they are at least more patient to finally let other people have their voice. And radio, public radio, national radio, puts on hours of interesting programming that, through the voice, brings culture, and I mean now serious culture, to an audience in a way that perhaps the privacy of a person before a screen or even the privacy of a person reading a book is at a relative disadvantage to that capacious and collective aspect of voice culture.
Yeah, to keep really on this theme, I wonder what your thoughts are on the culture of the virtual, what has sometimes been called electronic culture or digital culture. I wonder what this represents for the book culture, which we seem to be perhaps looking at as slightly menaced here. What I've seen of the hypertextual, for instance, seems strangely uncompelling. But
yes, I've likewise been hearing by now, I think it's for more than a decade, about the hypertext and how it is going to transform not only publishing but also the creation of fiction. And there are serious writers. I'm thinking of an American writer like Robert Coover, who seems to be quite invested in his creative energy, considerable creative energy, toward this possibility of hypertext. As you are, I'm still, as it were, waiting to be surprised and indeed overwhelmed by its potential. On the other hand, we've been likewise hearing for some time about interactive film, that there will be the possibility through computers to have an audience have a interactive relation to how the film turns out, to, as it were, adjust plots, adjust the fate of characters. This seems to me immensely interesting, and I gather, although I'm not an expert at all, increasingly available and possible. So that it may be that it's not so much the book or the particular genres of literature, such as the novel, that will be transformed by interactive and virtual possibilities. And I add parenthetically, perhaps that's not a bad thing. Perhaps books, precisely in their low-tech form of being bound in paper and carried around in a pocket or a briefcase, can happily remain just as they are, thank you. But perhaps it's a cinema, which after all has always been a highly adaptive, technologically driven art form. Perhaps it's in cinema that we will see the real potential of virtual culture.
Yes, Tim, I'd like to turn to something quite different, even though obviously there is a lot of overlapping. The figure of Jacques Derrida. You were a student of Derrida. You participated in numerous conferences in which Derrida also read papers. And you were also a friend of Derrida. So could you share some of your thoughts about the founding father of deconstruction?
I'd be happy to, although we will obviously have to be very brief about a man whose work was not only voluminous, but also so varied and so rich. Words like generous are often bandied about in our parlance, but one has to underscore the generosity of this man's mind as well as his person. He was not only interested in so many aspects of culture, of politics, as well as obviously professional philosophy, but he gave so much out in all of those directions. He traveled tirelessly, up to and including the period of his illness. He learned languages. He was someone who rarely said no to an invitation. Now, one of his most compelling contributions, I think, is to the debate about globalization. You may know that he refused the word. He didn't refuse the problem or the phenomenon, but in French it was easy to adopt an alternative, that is mondialisation. We can't quite say worldization in English, but what he meant by this alternative is that globalization threatens, as a concept, globalization threatens to drain humanity out of the problem. Whereas when you say world, and he draws from Heidegger in this point, when you say world, you realize that humans make a world, even if humans don't make a globe. And it is perhaps one of the ironies that although deconstruction is sometimes associated with a dismissive attitude toward man or toward humanism, that I think the record will show, and certainly I think the long term will bear out, that Derrida was intensely respectful and caring of what it means to be human in all of its aspects, racial, ethical, and indeed religious. Perhaps this is in part because he himself was such a wonderfully mixed human being. As you know, he was a Jew from Algeria, coming from a Sephardic tradition, who then came over to France and then eventually became an international citizen, as it were, doing a lot of teaching in the United States of America, but also all over the world. So that I think of him as a kind of model example of a human being of the world who, as it were, can speak and can represent worldization or mondialisation in a positive way, as an alternative to what otherwise is, an anti-humanist globalization.
One other question regarding Jacques Derrida, globalization, and also his term, mondialisation. Derrida believed that globalization is an illusion. Do you agree with Derrida? Do you feel that it is also an illusion? Basically, it is a simulacra which has been invented to deceive for purposes of deception.
I certainly believe that it has manipulative and deceptive aspects. But as we know, after Baudrillard and Derrida, simulacra are no less real in their effects for being, as it were, of a peculiar ontological status. And so globalization, even if we can critique it, is, as it were, advancing as a real force and a repeatedly powerful experience in many, many aspects. Principally, I think, through the power of marketing and publicity that, has enormous amounts of capital behind it. So that I think that to call something an illusion is both accurate and not a sufficiently critical instrument to address the issues that this illusion nonetheless presents as a reality in our day-to-day lives.
Yeah. I wonder if I could ask you now to speak to us a little bit about your current work in progress.
Well, it's ironic that as we spoke today about images and film and screens, that one of the things I've been interested in very much for the last few years is blindness. I have been working with the blind for several years in France, both teaching English to the blind and visiting blind people to help them in their lives. And I think that given the ubiquity or the near constancy of blindness as a metaphor in our cultures, from Oedipus forward, I thought it would behoove me to have some real experience with what blindness is. And so, Yvonne, one of the things I'm trying to write about now is how it is that we see blindness as people who are sighted, and what the interplay is between the powerful metaphoricity of blindness in philosophy, in literature, in psychoanalysis, and the real experience of either, on the one hand, being blind, or on the other hand, seeing with and for blind people.
That's very interesting. Can I ask you something else now about criticism's own work in progress? It seems that criticism might itself need to think about its own blindnesses and...
Well, criticism, as you know, has been a boom field for perhaps 40 years or more now, and such that now one can teach and publish and write in the domain of theory as if it were a genre of discourse in its own right. I think this is an immensely productive and salutary development. Surely reflections about literature, philosophy, and culture have become much the better, much more interesting because of this. On the other hand, there's the danger that as there are increasing numbers and increasing voices and, as it were, increasing idioms in this field, a certain commonality to the conversation is at risk. So that my own feeling is that we need to keep alive and keep recycling an understanding and an appreciation of certain key terms. To start, for example, with the word theory, that Théorène has an interesting visual component, or that the moment when a word like idea lost it the powerful visuality that it had in Greek culture and became, as it were, strictly an interior or verbal experience. Key words and, as it follows then, key authors and key texts have to be, I think, treasured. I'm not embarrassed to use that word, to be part of our thesaurus, part of our lexicon, that otherwise, as it were, we risk talking ever more and saying ever less.
Yes, Tim, one last question. You're a scholar in comparative literature. And comparative literature seems to focus more on the global, perhaps. It is more all-encompassing. And yet you also study the Mediterranean. You also focus on Mediterranean studies in your work. So what is the rapport between the global, so as to say, and the regional, between comparative literature on the one hand and Mediterranean studies on the other?
As you know, comparative literature as a discipline, initially had very universalizing pretensions that it would be able to develop an understanding and a theory of literature as if it were globally covered. In fact, we also know that it was an extremely Western and even Northwestern-centered appreciation and exploitation of the literary tradition. I, of course, love the Mediterranean. I've been delighted to be in Malta. And I think that regional approaches to comparative literature are both more realizable and, frankly, more intellectually honest. And a situation of Malta or around it, the situation of the Mediterranean, is, I think, a wonderful case study of how linguistic and literary and more broadly cultural study are frankly impossible without a comparatist approach, and yet the comparatist approach is perhaps the last to arrive in this situation. Rather than seeing this as something that we should moan or regret, I see it, on the contrary, as a great opportunity. I think Mediterranean studies and similar regional comparative studies are frankly the future of the humanities.
Gloria, baqa' għandna ftit ħin però ta' min forsi tfakkarna ftit xi nagħtef fl-intervista. Tkellimtu ħafna fuq endings fil-poeżija u fis-soċjetà. Fil-fatt kif huma konnessi dawn iż-żewġ tipi ta' endings.
Iva, il-professur Bati kiteb ktieb ferm importanti fuq il-poeżija jismu Ends of the Lyric. U hawnhekk għandna pan fuq il-kelma ends. Għala għaliex jianalizza kem l-aħħar lines ta' poeziji, per eżempju ta' Coleridge jew ta' Leopardi jew ta' Shakespeare, imma permezz ukoll ta' dawn landings janalizzaw ukoll il-fini l-iskop lens tal-poezija, jiġifieri kollox huwa mibni fuq gioco di parole, fuq pan, jiġifieri double meaning tal-kelma ends u endings. Tkellimna wkoll ħafna fuq landing ta' ħafna aspetti fis-soċjetà tagħna. Per eżempju, landing tal-print culture, wasanna fit-tmim tal-print culture, qed tiddomina l-image culture u fejn poġġu il-voice culture. Wara kollox ir-radio jirrappreżenta il-voice culture. Qed temerġi tip ta' kultura differenti wkoll id-digital culture u da kollu wkoll ikkollegajni. Għaliex da wara kollox huwa termini u terminoloġija biex ngħidu hekk ta' apokalissi meta ngħidu ending xi ħaġa qed tispiċċa. Kollegajna wkoll kollox ma' l-immaġini ta' Twin Towers ta' 9/11 fejn hemmhekk kellna katastrofi, immaġini katastrofika u saqsejna jekk appuntu hawnhekk m'għandniex forma ta' tmim ta' tip ta' soċjetà.
Xi ħaġa dwar Jacques Derrida, fil-fatt x'tip ta' rapport kellu l-professur Bati?
Iva, interessanti li l-professur Bati kellu żewġ maestri ferm kbar. Wieħed minnhom kien Paul Deman, il-teoriku Paul Deman u safrattant il-professur Bati għamel ukoll il-PhD miegħu Yale University ma' Paul Deman u kellu ukoll rapport ma' Jacques Derrida. Kien iffrekwenta ħafna mill-lezzjonijiet tiegħu, ipparteċipa f'ħafna konferenzi fejn ipparteċipa Jacques Derrida u tkellimna wkoll fuq il-kunċett ta' mondializzazzjon minn flok ta' globalization, termini illi Derrida insista ħafna fuq u appuntu biex jipprova jopponi dan il-fenomenu ta' globalizzazzjoni.
U b'dak l-aħħar kumment Gloria niġu fit-tmiem edizzjoni oħra ta' sensiela Laboratorju Letterarju nirringrazzjawkom talli kontu magħna mill-istudio sta Campus FM insalmulkom. Għadkom kem smajtu Laboratorju Letterarju. Vjaġġ fid-dinja tal-letteratura komparata.